Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info, hallel.info. Do we trust God in His promises? We can come up with all sorts of ideas about God, but if we really don't trust Him and His leading, why bother following? These are questions tackled in the following recorded discussion on the Torah portion Vayera, which means, "And He appeared." It covers Genesis 18 through 22. Hallel Fellowship teacher Jeff explores Avraham's trust issues up to this great test of faith from God to offer up his only son. At that point, Avraham sees something. This passage is all about the promised one, the Mashiach, or Messiah. He is represented by Avraham's son Yitzhak, or Isaac.
Today, with the parasha we're going over is called Vayera, or "And he saw," be a good way to, "And he sees." And that is one of the key things we're going to be looking at today is, what is it that was seen, and who saw it, and how far in the future were the people looking who are involved in this account that we're going over here. And some of the key things we'll be hitting as we go through this, we'll be mainly focusing on Genesis 22. And that's the account there of the offering of Yitzhak, or Isaac. But we'll be hitting some key, you'd say, highlights in some of the other chapters we'll be going over between chapters 18 and 22 of Genesis. So some of the things we'll be looking at in this is the promised one in here. The promised one is leading up throughout this whole portion to this promised one there in Yitzhak. And also along the way, that involved in here are some accounts that involve trust and how much people are going to trust God in what He's doing and what He says is going to happen throughout this. And one of those things we see is that is really a key thing of life and how we relate to God, because we can come up with all kinds of ideas about God, but if we don't trust Him when He says something and says this is the direction we need to go, then, you know, what we do is, you know, could really be better spent our time doing something else, because if you're not really going to trust in who it is that's leading, why bother following or even pretending to follow? You might as well do something else, spend your time a little bit better. So as we are continuing on through Genesis, this is the discussion of beginnings. We have to start out with the right beginning, because if we don't have the right beginning, we're not going to get to the right end. Because one of those things that has been, you could say, a sore point for a lot of folks who think that everything that exists just comes from what exists, is that you have to start with something. You know, whether one of the common things today is you push the beginning of all things into, now it's into some other universe or the multiverse. You have multiple universes out there, and just one, there was a whole bunch of rolling of the dice, and one of them just came up, and here we are. And this is the one that we're in, so yeehaw. That was a fantastic happenstance. Somebody was going to Vegas and hit the jackpot, and here we are. But one of those things is, if you just push it off into the multiverse, then you have to wonder, well, what started the multiverse? And everything goes up from there. And it's really the same thing with the beginning, Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Okay, what's the authoritative proof of that? You just have to trust it. You have to say, okay, that is a statement of reality. Because if you say that statement is true or that statement is false, then you are now taking some other authority upon that statement to say, oh, hey, that's true or that's false. So you have to start with somewhere. And that beginning of where you start really determines where you go with it. Because we talk about sola scriptura, or the Bible alone. Well, which books in the Bible? Who wrote those books? Are they authoritative? So suddenly now, it is what you think about the book that determines how you're going to approach the book. Are you going to take this, like what Messiah said, man doesn't live by bread alone, quoting from Deuteronomy, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God? Do you trust that? Do you trust that these are every word that's proceeding out of the mouth of God? Because if you don't, then you can start taking this book and twisting it any which way you want to go and coming up at a different destination than it starts with, and having all kinds of different ways to go with it. So really what we've been going through here in Genesis from the very beginning is which is the way that it was intended to go, and how is it getting there? Are people trusting the way it's going and the way that God intended for it to go? So today, as we look through here, we're just going to be hitting some highlights. Genesis 18, that first part in 18 verses 1 through 15, one of the key parts that you see in there is it's really a big event. God meets man in person. And you're thinking, well, okay, big event. Well, there were some other people who walked with God. See, Adam, Eve, and Enoch talked about walking with God. And even Cain, to a certain degree, you could say maybe he walked directly, or maybe he just heard a voice or whatever. But there was some direct contact there at that point. And Noah had some sort of relationship with God where God was giving him messages. And so then we were talking last time around on the going out of Abraham from where he started, where his family started, to someplace different. So as we come along here with this, as the last parasha ended with chapter 17 and this new deal that's coming through about this great nation and circumcision, as though last portion really about this great promise coming through. So as we come into 18, this is really leaving off where it was before with the circumcision and the end of that. So that's why some people say that as Genesis 17 ends with circumcision, that what you're seeing here in chapter 18 is like he's recovering from the circumcision. And so he's sitting there at the tent and people show up. And that is this encounter. Do you actually trust? And that's where Yitzhak's name comes from, about laughter, about laughing at such a crazy idea. Crazy idea that a very old woman, even though she was going to live to be very old beyond this, that a very old woman who had not had children before was then going to have children. And not just any child, but a child that was going to be great. And this people that was going to come out from the child was going to be fantastic. So you see there with this beginning part, who do you trust? And Sarah facing that decision of trusting that what God was saying was going to happen. That within 1 year's time, he was going to come back at an appointed time. And at that particular appointed time, you were then going to have this great blessing come. The next part, very interesting how that part ends. It ends with this laughter that Sarah has. The next part, starting in verse 16 of chapter 18 and really running through the next chapter 19, about Sodom and Gomorrah. So you're not only meeting face to face, but you're also having a decision now that God is publicly making, because he's making it there with Abraham, and then he's now having to decide what to do with Sodom and Gomorrah.
Before you move on to Sodom and Gomorrah, could you answer me the question of why Sarah was chastised for laughing inwardly while Abraham laughed out loud and was not chastised?
Well, the promise was coming through her. Yeah. That's right. So the... Yeah, so it's all about laughter, because this actually, this laughter will come up again in chapter 21. Yeah, because you'll see that this laughter comes up again in chapter 21, and you'll see that why a lot of translations will put it as mockery, when strictly speaking it just says laughter. When Yishmael says that he was engaging in mocking, but the word strictly speaking just means to laugh. So we'll be kind of getting a look at that picture. Because really, that really just sums up a lot of what we've been talking about so far, is, and really something that a lot of us face when people are talking to us about it, or we're talking to other people about it, is like, you have got to be kidding. You really believe that? That is really, I mean, the same thing that Sarah was facing is the same thing we face today. It's the same thing that a lot of people face. And we'll see that in a few examples here in chapter 20. Again, it shows up. This, you've got to be kidding. This is really going to happen to an old woman who hasn't had children.
I was reading some scripture this morning, and it was talking about the men and how old they were when they begat, when they...
Yeah.
Helped to beget children.
Yeah.
And how old they were.
Mm-hmm.
But it never mentioned how old the women were when they begat, when they became pregnant.
That's right.
So I thought that was really interesting, because so I could see why she would laugh.
Yeah.
Because mostly women gave birth in their youth as opposed to being 100 years old.
Yeah.
But men could keep on propagating.
Yeah, because when you even look at the proportional age, because, you know, she lived to a very old age, but that's still very old in her life.
And Scripture said it ceased to be with her after the way of women, which meant she had passed her childbearing age.
That's right.
Everything was not working anymore.
Yep. So it's beyond the point of an expectation that this was going to be happening naturally. So that's something that we face here. At a point when things seem impossible, is God still going to act? Is this actually going to happen, something that he promised? And we see that really throughout the whole story of the people of God, throughout the nation of Israel and the prophetic writings and such. Is the, for example, when the exiles come along, the whole nation gone, cut off, dead for all intents and purposes. Is that actually going to come back? Is it actually going to come back? And when you look at it, you think, well, nope. And as we were going through Deuteronomy, you saw in the last few chapters, a lot of people will look and see at the actions of God in this case, and you'll say, whoo boy, nope, they're toast. And sadly, that's come to be an interpretation that people have had in looking at the reactions of, the Messiah when he comes into the temple, you know, and he says, your house is left you desolate. And then you see later on the Apostle Paul says, I've had it. I'm now going to the nations. And so, again, people go, oh, that's it. Written off. Cut off. Cut off and no more on that. But, you know, you would have said that that was going to happen with Israel. But there was the promise that that was going to be a great nation. And a great nation that was going to be a blessing to all nations. So that goes back to the original thing we were talking about at the beginning. The way that it was intended to go. And then the way that it ended up going with people trying to help God in various cases and not really trusting what his plan was, but trying to devise their own plan. So as we go on into this case of Sodom and Gomorrah, you know, people have come up with various cases of what the actual problem with Sodom and Gomorrah is, related to hospitality would be. Because you see in the parallel passages in the prophets as they talk about Sodom and Gomorrah, one of the things there about being inhospitable, which is kind of interesting because That is one of the things that you see at the beginning part of chapter 18, when Abraham is interacting with these three visitors. You see this extreme hospitality showing up in this case, this being extremely welcoming of these visitors who come in. So you contrast that with what comes later with the two of those visitors when they go down into Sodom, the reception that they get. So beyond what else was going on in Sodom, one of the things was, how do you receive not only just people in general, but how do you receive God when he's making a visit?
So he knew that that was God, right?
Because Abraham?
My Bible says Abraham knew it was God.
Well, later on you start getting that sense as to what's happening, especially when they start in the latter part as you get into chapter 18, verse 16 and on, when you start having this, it looks like a negotiation between Abraham and God about whether Sodom and Gomorrah are going to be toast or not, and what kind of threshold of righteousness was to be even expected in those cities and the surrounding area. Otherwise, they would be toast. So one of those things is you've got not only hospitable, that he was being hospitable to these people coming in, originally not suspecting who they were, and then eventually you can see he gets the idea of who they were and moving forward. But then the concern about other people in there. Because you see what happens later on in chapter 19 when the two angels go in and end up having to drag out Lot. Yeah, they had to drag him out of the place. So in those cases, you have the situation that God could deliver Lot and his family out. Okay. But what about anybody else in Sodom? And as you see later on, there was even some in-laws of Lot that didn't want to leave.
The two daughters that he took with him, he had more daughters than that.
Yes,
so,
sadly.
I mean, is there any inclination in any teaching anywhere of how he felt about losing those family?
Well, and you wonder in the reaction of the wife with her looking back. Well, I think, you know, what are you going to look back to? You could think first off would be your kids. And then, you know, beyond that, you've got all your friends and your acquaintances and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Whatever your ties to a place you were at before might be. But that's a great observation, is that she lost at least two daughters. And that's what's mentioned there. Plus the in-laws and however she felt about the in-laws as well. And maybe the grandchildren of those in-laws and the daughters. So you're talking about the great sort of loss that was happening here with Abraham saying, you know, at least 10. I mean, could you spare the city? So it means that not only just Lot and his family, but also the people around there, spare them for at least that. So when we look in our society today, you know, how much concern do we have for the people there? And you think of some of the places around that just seem to be, you know, hotbeds of just total disregard for God whatsoever. You know, we could think of locally, like here in, you know, Sonoma County, and a lot of places where you have church attendance that's kind of gone off the cliff, or you go out to Berkeley or San Francisco, or out and out and out and out, even to Tel Aviv or even to Jerusalem itself, and see what kind of disregard there is for God in certain places. So it's like, do we have the attitude of Abraham that we care about people who may be going up? You know, as Paul puts it, are we concerned about people who may just be escaping through the flames, like Lot did? Lot had the flames of Sodom and Gomorrah, you could say, you know, figuratively speaking, you know, lapping at his heels there, so to speak. So that he was definitely escaped as through the flames. And that's, as the Apostle Paul puts it, as being a situation that you don't want to be in. That's like, wow, you barely made it only but for the grace of God. Of course, we all only make it but for the grace of God. But
now, didn't he originally go to another city and then into the mountains?
Well, he was wanting to go. He said, how about just send me over to this little city here? And then, yeah, and then later on it's like, eventually, okay, no, we got to get out. It's one of those things where that's eventually ended up in the cave. That's kind of where the things go. So you see that in chapter 19. But then we get into chapter 20. In chapter 20, we call it the sister act, because really this is it seems like deja vu yet again and again and again, because it happens twice with Abraham. And we're seeing it for the second time here for Abraham, and then for his son also pulls the same maneuver with even less less veracity.
But before you move over to 20, what I don't understand is there was this whole scene with incest.
Yes.
I can't fathom in my brain. I mean, even if you...
That kind of decision?
Well, yeah, because even if you saw the entire valley go up in smoke and you come to that decision, I'm sorry, but there's got to be... You got to have at least Abraham's side. And it's like, it's like the saying...
There's somebody
else.
Even
if you were the last man on earth type of thing.
Right.
It's like, he wasn't the last man on earth.
Right.
That's what I don't understand, is what was going on up here with them. Because that just... It's...
Wanting to continue on with the family line. And then,
there's other ties.
Well, the point is that, as the account says, they thought that that was it. As the account says, they thought that they were the last ones left. So, you know, it does make you wonder when you think of, okay, Lot being dragged out of there. Well, what about Abraham? You think the uncle would be a little bit more, actually, not uncle, but further relation, would be even more, you know, righteous, so to speak, than that. But that does bring up the great case of what were they possibly thinking? What were they possibly thinking?
Those of you who are old enough to remember this, when you're a teenager, how well do you think?
Not great.
Not very well. I didn't think well. I'm sure nobody else here thought well as teenagers. Mind you, these ladies, girls, were too young to have married off already. So they're probably in their early teens. They're not thinking very well. So cut them some slack. Fair enough.
Yeah. Well, but one of the points that you have to look at in this is that this is a cascade that has gone down several degrees in this. In the one case of the progression of Lot into Sodom, then the lingering around in Sodom to leave, and then leaving with the situation where then the descendants of Lot end up being a challenging foe, you might say, for Israel later on. So it's one of those cases. We're going to see it also again with Ishmael and Yitzhak, is that one of those cases of not really wanting to trust where God is leading leads down to a path where you end up having to deal with the consequences of it. Yes, the exiles of Israel were resolved, but how many ended up returning out of that? Very, very few. So was that a great blessing for Israel to get exiled? Not a blessing whatsoever. Because if it was a blessing, what were all the prophets for? They should have just shut up and let them go off into exile, because that would be a great blessing. Israel did return, and they went through the thing of Ezra and Nehemiah and rebuilding the wall, putting that all back together and stuff. But that was not something that was the great result or the great part of the plan.
Now, because of they sinned almost kind of like Ham did, and they cursed the whole nation, and then the Moabites became cursed people too.
Yeah.
Because of those two, right?
Yeah. So then you see what happens to the descendants of these girls and what the road that they were going down in. And you think of Ishmael and all the people after that. And as we get on to chapter 21, I think one of the things that we should take into account is the anguish that Abraham feels over Ishmael. And also the fact that God gives a promise to Ishmael. Should be a little bit of a lesson, even in that this is something that wasn't God's original plan as to how this promise was going to work out. But there was also going to be a promise for Ishmael. Was that a great thing for the world? Has the world really benefited from the past, 1,400 years of an onslaught of the descendants of Ishmael going throughout the world and subjugating it? Has that been a great blessing for the world?
No.
No. However, this was something that God said, because of Abraham, I'm going to bless you as well. So, it's interesting, we'll be getting to this in chapter 21, but Hagar was from Egypt. The wife for Ishmael, his first wife, was from Egypt. So then you start getting a little bit of a, maybe that's why you start seeing Egypt show up in the stuff related to the day of the Lord and the prophecies there. It seems like kind of a weird sort of connection that God has with Egypt and in the future, and even later on in the time of the Exodus.
This is a little off topic, but I just kind of noticed a parallel with the story of Esther, because we have God giving Ishmael this blessing, and then, but the promise given to Isaac, actually, he didn't remove the blessing from Ishmael, but he gave Isaac a bigger one that would eventually overcome that one. And we've got the same where the king makes a decree that allows for the outwiping of the Jews in the realm, but then he can't remove that, but then he does make another decree that basically overruns the first one. It's kind of an interesting parallel.
It is an interesting parallel. And one of the things that you see is a part of the continuing blessing for Ishmael, as we get to it, is that at least they have some sort of heritage back to Abraham. And that heritage back to Abraham, over time, people have listened. People have listened. Even if it's kind of like, you are driving far away from some radio station, you can just barely hear it through all the static. There are people who have come down through the descendants, either metaphorically or physically, through Ishmael, who have heard through the static and continue to hear through the static and hear the true God and hear about the one, the promised one, kind of in the line like Yitzhak, and realize that that promised one was going to be the Messiah of Israel, and decide that put the trust in the Messiah of Israel instead of the Messiah of Ishmael. So we'll be getting to that a little bit later. But one of the key things that we see in chapter 20 as we transition forward is the Messiah of Ishmael.
Oh, you mean the bad one?
Interesting. Yes. Yes. So it is quite interesting that you do have a companion there, and those are kind of the descendants of Ishmael in this. And we'll be getting to Galatians here in a moment, chapter 4, where we have this kind of contrast between Hagar and Sarah and their children that really puts us into perspective for not only us today, but also as we think about this, yearning heart, just like Abraham and his heart yearning for the saving people out of Sodom and Gomorrah, that also the yearning heart for Abraham, for Ishmael.
Yeah.
So with this in chapter 20, one of the things to look at is, you know, just like we were mentioning there in chapter 12 of Genesis, you saw the last parasha, the encounter there with the Pharaoh, and claiming, oh, she's my sister. Well, you know, in a slight sense, yes, but what is the more relevant relationship? The more relevant relationship is that they're married. Yeah, that's the most relevant one, and that was the one he was fibbing on. And then you see it here again as he's dealing with Abimelech or however you want to pronounce that. Basically, kind of looks like it's two words there, Avi, my father, and Melech, meaning king or ruler. So my king is ruler, or my king the ruler, or something like that. Then you see later on, as we're going to get into this in the next parasha, of another Abimelech of Philistia. And it's kind of interesting that this parasha that we're in right now also ends with dealings with Philistia as well, which is very interesting later on when we talk about the relationships that the people of Israel had with those around them. And they cut deals. They cut deals with Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. They cut deals with all these folk. Yet, later on, when it comes down to honoring these deals, these arrangements of like, okay, you're over there, just let us be. You're over there, just let us be. But we see with Philistia, that was not the case at all. And later on, becoming quite a thorn in the side of Israel.
One of the kings that took Sarah, or was that her name, Sarah?
Sarah, yeah.
Okay. He took her, but then he paid something to release her.
Yeah, that's what we're talking about, like here in chapter 20, with the having to give a bit of a concession gift to basically make Abraham go away. Go away.
Oh, is that what that
yes,
was?
Go away.
But it says to clear her.
Yes, to clear, and to also, you know, because one of the things that you saw not only in chapter 12, but also here in chapter 20, is that both Pharaoh and Abimelech go, uh-oh. You know, instead of, you know, you would think of, like, it's good to be king and you can just grab whoever you want. They realize that they blundered big time. And you see in, probably in some of these cases, after Abraham's subjugating of the five chieftains, kings of the time period, that people realized that he was definitely a force to be reckoned with, not just, you know, militarily, but then also you see later on with the relationships of the sons and such, that this is a force to be reckoned with in the land. Realizing who he was and that he deserved respect and not to slight him. And, you know, also, as we were kind of going through before, when you look at the genealogies back in chapter 5 of Genesis and chapter 11, you're seeing that this is not a long period of time between when the flood happened and the dispersal of the nations and when this is happening. You know, we're talking only hundreds of years, not thousands, not tens of thousands of years. So you get the picture of a cultural overlap between the family of Noah and these generations of people here in this area.
Kind of makes me think that if we are not willing to learn from observation of other people's mistakes, then God will teach us or himself. And so those kings who thought, oh, it's good to be king, I'll take this pretty lady. And they took Sarah, and then they found out that she was not somebody who should be taken. You know, if they had just, you know, learned from observing Abraham and how powerful he was and that he was actually their equal, they would never have done that. But because they did not treat him as their equal or even their superior, they presumed that they had the right to take from him what he wanted, and God had to teach him a lesson that, no, you don't. Not to Abraham, you don't. Mm-mm.
Could it be that Abimelech kept her longer than the others? Because God had to visit him.
It is.
Do you think?
Well, it is entirely possible.
You are making a similarity comparison between the Pharaoh of Egypt and Abimelech.
Mm-hmm.
And you were saying that they both understood that they had to let the Hebrews go. But if I remember right, the Pharaoh this changed his mind.
You're talking about the later Pharaoh.
Oh, so this is not the Pharaoh that...
She was taken a few times.
Yes.
Oh, different Pharaoh. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah. No. This is about at least a few hundred years before that, the Exodus Pharaoh. Yeah. And you're probably talking about even a different people group because, you know, about the one who didn't know Yosef rose up. So, there's thought period that you could have that transition of even a different type of kingdom in Egypt showed up at that time. So, it is kind of an interesting. They didn't know Yosef, so maybe not even by reputation, not even by the cultural overlap down from Noah that other Pharaoh knew. Yeah, that's the idea. And you see that in Egypt's history that you had a huge transition of power in Egypt between who was there at the beginning part and then who was then there in the later part of Egypt. So as we get on to chapter 21... One of the things to really look at in this is this rivalry. And this rivalry between the houses of Ishmael and the house of Yitzhak. And this thing is still with us today because of the great prophecy and promise that was given to Ishmael that he would also be a great ruler. So you see in the first part of this section, like in the first seven verses, you see that as Abraham is turning 100, this is that year after we saw the back in Genesis 18, so we're seeing the fulfillment of this a year later, that here you are having this promise starting to get fulfilled with the birth of Yitzhak. So fantastic thing that's happening. And you see in there the mention, like in verse 4 that of chapter 21, that Abraham circumcised his son Yitzhak when he was 8 days old, as God had commanded him. And, of course, that command came back in chapter 17, where you had that the command that Abraham was to circumcise all of the males under his, because this was a part of that, you know, sign deal of who this family was going to be. So this is not something that was a part of Sinai. This was something that was long before that. In fact, as you see on the account of the Exodus later on, they had to remember that this was something that was a part of the deal that came all the way down from Abraham. Things that were forgotten, even Moshe had neglected to circumcise one of his children. Yes, and that was the account of Yes, where the Lord came to take the life of the kid.
But wasn't that because his wife?
Well, it's one of those things, you know, she originally, you'd say, was from Midian, so the responsibility was upon him.
Oh.
He was the one that was supposed to be keeping it up. Well, she was the one, his wife had to step in to actually do that. And then you see that great prophecy and kind of a prophetic statement, even messianic prophetic statement, is saying, you have become a bridegroom of blood to me. Well, it is quite interesting that it's like you've neglected to do something, so now the life of the firstborn has to be taken. So, kind of a very interesting side point in this. But this point here that we're seeing here with Abraham and Isaac and circumcising them on the eighth day is something that, we'll just take a quick little side tour into Galatians chapter 4 and look at briefly at this account. And remember again that Paul builds on a lot of his letters, not all of them, but a number of his letters have large sections of them that build upon point after point after point. And you know, Galatians is one of those where the point builds over a few chapters. So dropping into the midst of it is always a bit challenging, because you might get the wrong idea if you are not looking at the context too large. But one of the things you'll notice in going through Galatians is that the topic of circumcision is a big, big, big deal. Huge deal is what's going on here. So, you know, one of the things that that you look at in tradition of the time period in the first century, stuff that's recorded down there, is that one of the key things in leading to this rivalry, and perhaps that's part of legend on the backstory that you're seeing there of the mocking going on in chapter 21 of Genesis, is that this view of, well, I'm Ishmael, and I chose. I was at 13, and I was, quote, chose. I had some sort of volition, some sort of decision going on with circumcision. Although you could think of, like, yeah, how far is his decision one way or the other going to go at 13? But Yitzhak, eighth day. There was certainly no choice whatsoever on that. In fact, you know, probably not even remember it happening. So one of the things that's brought up in that point is, in tradition, is that part of the mocking was, hey, I'm better because I chose this deal of the family. So I'm better, I chose it. I wasn't just, quote, you know, born into it, unquote. So some of what you see in here in Paul's discussion could be getting at that popular idea that you see kind of grew out of the Maccabean era, where circumcision was one of the things that got people killed under the Seleucid Empire when they came in Antiochus and he abolished Torah. And one of those things, two things that were really big on the list was circumcision and Shabbat keeping. But other things, even reading the Torah itself or teaching it to your kids, was on the, you know, capital punishment list. So huge deal. So one of the things that you see in rabbinical literature following that time period was the circumcision was a huge deal, because that was one of the banners of circumcision, and Shabbat were two banners seen as this is what it means to be a part of Israel. And this is one of the key markers of being a part of Israel. So thus, when you see this showing up as in Galatians, that's addressing a huge deal of it. Is, okay, are you choosing? Are you born into it? Are you promised into it? Was really what we'll see in this passage. So let's take a look at Galatians chapter 4. We'll be dropping into this discussion here a bit. Galatians chapter 4, and we'll be starting there with verse 21. And going through 31. Tell me, you who are want to be under law, do you not listen to the law? For it is written that Abraham had two sons, one by the bondwoman and one by the free woman. But the son by the bondwoman was born according to the flesh, and the son by the free woman through the promise. This is allegorically speaking. For these women are two covenants, one proceeding from Mount Sinai, bearing children who are to be slaves. She is Hagar. Now this Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia, and corresponds to the present Yerushalayim. For she is in slavery with her children. But the Yerushalayim above is free. She is our mother. For it is written, rejoice, barren woman who does not bear. Break forth and shout, you who are not in labor. For more numerous are the children of the desolate than the one who has a husband. And you, brethren, like Yitzhak, are children of promise. But as at that time, who was born according to the flesh persecuted him who was born according to the spirit, so it is now also. But what does the scripture say? Cast out the bondwoman and her son, for the son of the bondwoman shall not be an heir with the son of the free woman. So then, brethren, we are not children of the bondwoman, but of the free woman. And so that is, as you see in verse 31, that is the punchline of Paul's point here. And you can start seeing it like, okay, well, the whole Sinai thing, you know, born into slavery, which seems quite odd because that's like after the Exodus, which was delivering from the house of bondage. So how can you be delivered from the house of bondage into slavery? Unless something horrifically had gone wrong in how the people were approaching what it meant to be a part of Israel. What it meant to be a part of Israel, and you see it later on as they're getting ready after the Exodus and after the 40 years and the next generation getting ready to enter the land, they had to be circumcised before they went in. Huh, that's very interesting. I was circumcised after they went in. Yes, thank you. Thank you. After they crossed over.
So if I understand this portion in Galatians right, the bondwoman is the analogy of following the Torah for the sake of earning your own salvation. And the free woman is following the Torah for the sake of love. Is that correct?
Well, one of those things that you see in there is what value do you place upon the circumcision? Was it like the taking it as I chose it, so now I'm in it? Or is it the promise? Because you see this key that keeps getting given again and again and again. And you see it developing even further about, in Romans you see it even develop further with the point that was Abraham given the promise and considered righteous, credited to him as righteous, before or after circumcision? It was before. Circumcision followed it. The sign, you could say, the deal and whatever, followed after he was already declared righteous. And that is then the point here of what Paul is making, is that this promise that is given, that people can enter into, and these nations, the Gentiles, can enter into, is that promise precedes any sort of, you could say, stamping of the deal that comes down, the signing of the contract, you could say, that you're already a citizen coming in. Yeah, and so that is one of those things that you're saying, that's the Yerushalayim of above. You know, you're not talking about some other capital. This is the place where God put his name. Well, and God said he was putting his name into one particular place. So what is it that is the source of, you could say, the foundation of that city? Because one of the things you see in Hebrews chapter 11 is that Abraham is you could say, given a great accolade. He's congratulated and lifted up as being someone who saw a city with foundations. But those foundations, the architect was God, was made that. Not somebody had built that and say, we built it and thus it would be great. Because one of those things that the scene is very interesting about this is that Abraham is living amidst a bunch of cities. He's living amidst a bunch of cities, but he is not in a city. That is a very interesting thing. He's a great power in this land, and yet he is not in a city. He's in the outskirts, which is very interesting, because what are cities known for, especially in that particular time period? Walls. Walls, protection, something like that. Living outside of a city, you're like, wow, it's difficult to defend. I mean, you can build stockades and all kinds of stuff, but they're not as tough as a wall with stone or embankments or something like that. So very interesting that when we're talking about trust here, this trust that God was building him into a great power without the benefit of walls, without the benefit of a city that you could trust in. And you see that later in the history of Israel, right near the end, near the exiles, where they're saying, don't trust in Egypt. Don't trust in their chariots. Don't trust in their horses and all this stuff. Don't trust in those things that you think that are physically going to bring you some sort of great power.
So taking a step back, Abimelech probably took Sarah because Abraham didn't have those walls, so he thought, well, he's an easy target.
Yeah.
Okay, but then he found out the hard way that he wasn't an easy target.
Not an easy target whatsoever.
So that's how he gained a reputation of being, while I don't have walls, I'm still protected.
Yeah. So who is the actual guarantor of your security? Who's the actual guarantor of your authority? Is it your walls? Is it the crown on your head? Or is it some sort of great power that makes people in walls with crowns on their head cower and fear? Well, it's the one who crossed over. And that was the great accolade that you see put forward, that he was the one who crossed over, meaning one of the ideas of that's thought of the term crossed over is the one who crossed over the Euphrates, meaning the big river coming from Mesopotamia. So one who crossed over then. And then you see later on, you could probably even apply that to the Nile then later on with Israel. They crossed over yet again. So they crossed over going into Egypt, and they crossed over going out, and even crossed over an even bigger one when they went across the Red Sea. So they were definitely people who crossed over huge barriers that would normally stop other armies. See later on when they took Babylon, they had to drain the river because it was a big obstacle in that path. So one of the things that we see here in this picture with Yitzhak and Ishmael is this real sense of promise and a real sense of, you could say, entitlement. You get in this picture and you see kind of later on as Paul riffs on the idea is that the covenant of Ishmael is a sense of entitlement. It is, I got this stamp, so we are all good. Versus the covenant, the contract related to the promise, related to the gift of God, is what you see through Ishmael. It is something that you did not have anything to do with. There on the eighth day, that is before you had any sort of choice or any way to get in or out of it. So as we close out this part, let's actually go through and read Genesis 22. So we're going to read through this because this it makes a huge deal on the whole rest of all that we see in Israel's history. And you'll see the Messiah and also the apostles will riff on this passage and the stuff that you see in here a lot. Now it came about after these things that God tested Abraham and said, Abraham. And he said, Here I am. He said, Now take your son, your only son, whom you love, Yitzhak, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains, which I tell you. So Abraham rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey and took two of his young men with him and Yitzhak his son, and he split wood for the burnt offering. And he rose and went to the place of which God had told him. On the third day, Abraham raised his eyes and saw the place from a distance. Abraham said to his young men, Stay here with the donkey, and I and the lad will go over there, and we will worship and return to you. Abraham took the wood and the burnt offering and laid it on Yitzhak his son. And he took in his hand the fire and the knife. So the two of them walked on together. Yitzhak spoke to Avraham, his father, and said, "My father." And he said, "Here I am, my son." And he said, "Well, behold, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" And Avraham said, "God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son." So the two of them walked on together. Then they came to the place of which God had told them. And Avraham built the altar there and arranged the wood and bound his son Yitzhak and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Avraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, "Avraham, Avraham!" And he said, "Here I am." He said, "Do not stretch out your hand against the lad and do nothing to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." Then Avraham raised his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him a ram caught in the thicket by his horns. Now Avraham went and took the ram and offered him up for a burnt offering in the place of his son. Avraham called the name of that place, "The Lord will provide." As it is said to this day, "In the mount of the Lord it will be provided." Then the angel of the Lord called to Avraham a second time from heaven and said, "By myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this thing and not withheld your son, your only son, I indeed will greatly bless you, and I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and as the sand which is on the seashore. And your seed shall possess the gates of their enemies. And in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice." So Avraham returned to his young men, and they arose and went together to Beersheba. And Avraham lived at Beersheba. Now it came about after these things, as was told to Avraham, saying, "Behold, Milcah also has borne children to your brother Nahor. Uz the firstborn, and Buz his brother, and Kemuel, the father of Amram, and Chesed, and Chazo, and Pildash, and Yitlaf, and Betuel." Now Betuel became the father of Rivka. These eight Milcah bore to Nahor, Abraham's brother. His concubine, whose name is Reumah, also bore Tebah and Gaham and Tahash and Makah. So a number of these things that you see in here, you see some key markers here that this was going to be on the third day. So it gives you a little bit of a clue. There are some other clues that you get throughout Scripture, but when it talks about, you know, on the third day, according to the Scriptures, that's he was going to be rising. So it seems kind of odd. You get this picture of here, this weird picture. It was like, well, wait a minute. On the third day, we have a sacrifice. How could this be on the third day he was going to rise and according to the Scriptures? Yes, God gave him back his life. And you'll see that in one of the accounts that we'll get to as we go forward. You'll see it, especially in the Hebrews account in 11 verse 19. You'll see specifically why it is that this prophecy of resurrection, when you would say, okay, this is a time of a sacrifice death, that this was going to be expecting that to happen on the third day. So another thing that you see that's really pictured in this is the place. That there was, he keeps saying this, and that became a marker throughout kind of rabbinical writings, the Hamakom, that place, that this is going to happen. This is a very specific place that this was going to be happening. And that also took on a huge significance. So it was going to happen a certain time, it was going to happen in a certain place.
Is that like the Passover?
Well, the Passover then takes up an interesting point because you have the Passover than talking about the front end of this. This is really, I guess, talking about the back end of this. The back end of it, the resurrection. Because just as what Pat was talking about, the getting the Son back from the dead, that's what happened on the third day. The Son did not die. The Son, quote, came to life. And you'll see it mentioned there in Hebrews as he proverbially, he as like a proverb, as a parable, he came to life on that day. So that's where you get the picture of the coming back to life. Now, the other picture at the other end of the Lamb, whose blood was shed to block the destroyer, is really the front end of that.
So God saved him because he called to Abraham, right?
Well, one of those things that he said was, I now see that you have not withheld. So he was like fully going forward. And you'll see as we get to Hebrews on the account of why he was going forward with this. Kind of the spoilers, so to speak, on that would be that he knew, he finally trusted that even if he was like going through to the point of a sacrifice, that God would bring him back from the dead. That he would actually resurrect him if it even got that far.
There was another teaching that I attended, and it was talking about how when he's describing to his servants that went with him and his son, he said that I and the boy are going to go up, and then we will both come down to you. You know, so he knew what he was going to do.
That's right.
But he had such a faith in God that, you know, God wouldn't allow for his son to perish.
Yeah. So it's kind of a great picture that after all of this, kind of like starting from Genesis 12 on, after all these times where you've sort of got him looking like he's not so great in his trust category and his faith in God, kind of wavers in a few cases there, and talking with the whole thing of she's my sister, and then, you know, later on with the kind of fretting over Ishmael, and even the whole thing about Ishmael. And to begin with, then, you know, interceding for Sodom and stuff like that, you start seeing this picture of you know, wavering back and forth and trusting what God is actually doing. But in this case, you'll see that it really came down to it, his full trust.
But he had family in Sodom. I would have been asking God too for
help. Yeah, you betcha. But it's one of those cases, do you trust what God is actually going to do in the midst of that?
In this telling of Yitzhak being almost sacrificed, mm-hmm. Where does it say that he was at Mount Moriah? Hmm? How do they say that that the temple was built where Abraham sacrificed or tried to sacrifice Yitzhak? That's supposed to be Mount Moriah, right?
Yes.
Where does it say that?
Oh, I have to go back and actually take a look at that. I know I've looked at that in times past as to where you'll see it later on talked about where Moriah is and the place of the temple. Yes, and that's something I have to go back and look at where the specific reference to that is. No, not tradition whatsoever. Because you'll see in a number of cases where they keep drilling down that this is going to be the specific place. And you even see a little bit of that in the account of where David actually conquers Jerusalem. You'll see a little bit of that picture as well. But that's a good point. Next time around, we'll get back with those specific references of the tie. You could say the as they call it, the chain of title. Going from Moriah all the way down. And look at this. She looks like she's got an answer.
Mount Moriah is identified with the mountain of Jerusalem where the temple was erected. And this 2 Chronicles 3:1, this is when Solomon had built the temple of the Lord. It says, and then Solomon began to bless the house of the Lord in Jerusalem on Mount Moriah.
Yeah, there
we
go.
The Lord had appeared to his father David at the place that David had prepared on the threshing floor of Oron the Jebusite.
Yeah, there we go. Well, but that's where it was. It was on Moriah.
Jeff? Hmm?
Like right in the beginning part of chapter 22, it talks about Moriah.
Yeah, chapter 22, the second verse, it says to get into the land of Moriah,
yes.
And I'll tell you which hill to go to.
Yes. Right. Yeah, so that's where it says there at the beginning part of chapter 22. Chapter 22, verse 2, says the land of Moriah, Mount Moriah, and then later on, when you she was talking about with the dedication of the temple, that was dedicated there at Moriah. So there we go, chain of title. So we go through. But yeah, that's a good point, because sometimes you get these bits of tradition that make extrapolations that aren't in the text. So it's in fighting. Yeah, that is certainly, there's a lot of chains of title. And even in that passage that she mentioned there from Chronicles, it points back to that time of David actually taking that specific place. And even in that account, you'll see that it's very specific about this is a place that is going to have to be taken and with a lot of significance as to why. So you could say it's kind of the family taking the title back, so to speak. So let's take a look at some of these passages where some of the themes that you'll see get riffed on in various parts of what the apostles talk about. You know, one of those we all know about there in John 3:16, you know, about God loved the world, and you know, see it written all over the place. But he gave his one and only son. And you'll see that mentioned several times in this passage so far here, that was a huge detail in this. That's, you have not spared your son, your one son, or your single son, your only son there. You've not spared that. So just like, you know, Abraham is willing to give over his son, God says, going to give the only son. And instead, the only son of God is the one who redeems the only son of Yitzhak. And so it ends up becoming a little bit like a recursive loop, you know. The only son of God is the one who redeemed the only son of Abraham. And so that allowed that line to continue on down.
This was a shadow of what was to come.
Oh, yes. Because one of those, talking about getting your attention on this, because you'll see later on when you get into the Torah, this sort of child sacrifice is frowned on hugely heavily. And then you'll see later on in the writings that this was a huge problem. The Valley of Hinnom with the child sacrifices and passing your children through the fire to Molech and stuff, that was a huge problem with Israel's strain away from God. So this idea of child sacrifice, big frowned on upon. So it's like, talk about getting his attention here. It's like, well, are you really the one who, this is a very different sort of thing to see from you. So then later on, when you see that it's actually not what God is doing here, that he's actually pointing forward to something, then you start seeing, oh, this is what this God is all about. This is not like what all the deities of the peoples around us, or the peoples in the land even. You see, that was a big problem.
But all of those deities were of children that had no choice. I always thought Yitzhak could have said no. He was old enough to say no.
Yeah, because in that you see that there is a lot of volition in this, his decision. That he actually went along with it.
Well, I think Richard taught us that Moriah meant from Yah Sea.
Well, it's one of the other ways you can slice Moriah is Yah on the end of it, and the other part is Mountain of God. So Mar Yah. That's another way you can slice the word. It's one of those things with Hebrew, especially with name and place designations, is you'll look in some lexicons and they'll slice and dice it a few different ways because of how the words get derived and change around. You add a letter in here and there, and it can be a completely different word. So, yeah, you can see. But one of the things about, so you say, will be seen there is what Yirah, the Lord, Yahweh Yirah, the Lord, it's translated often, will provide or will such, but it literally means the Lord will, you can see. The Lord, he will see, or something of that sort. So that's where you get this part. And some translations will say, the Lord will be seen. So you'll get this picture that the Lord will be seen in what's happening there in Moriah. And so later on with the time of Messiah, you'll see that indeed the Lord was seen in what was going on there. And the one and only Son of God. So one of the other passages we have up here is Romans 5:8. And this is really a great sort of thing as we talk about which comes first, the signing of the contract or the deal itself, the kind of, you could say, the gift of God. By this, the love of God has been manifest or really made flesh in us, that while we were still sinners, Messiah died for us. So this and another passage talks about the lamb slain from the foundations of the world. So you get the picture of the Passover and also what we have here in Moriah. So both parts of that, of the cleaning up what the mess that really started in the Garden of Eden, and then also bringing people back to life. Not condemning, but actually bringing them to life out of it. So in a very parabolic, like a parable sense, Lot was resurrected from Sodom because, he would have been toast in there in Sodom. But God plucked him out of that. And that's why, the apostle talks about one escaping through the flames.
Was Lot talked about anymore after all that Moabite stuff happened with his daughters, or is he just forgotten?
Well, you talk about, he's mentioned in the apostolic scriptures as far as that goes. But when you talk about those accounts, you just mainly get his descendants. But he factors in what the apostles, the Messiah, talk about with Lot. But it's one of those things with especially the being swept away part. It's one of those comparisons, and they're like the flood. So we just read about the flood before. This is almost in a similar situation with Sodom. Is, which was the which was good, to be in Sodom and get swiped away by the fire and such, or to be remaining afterward. And
well,
so.
Yeah,
it's a pretty bad situation. But as you look in chapters earlier, it was a kind of a declining hill downward from there, from moving into Sodom and then having the challenge in getting out. But one of those things that you saw was, when you talk about the righteousness of Lot, was that he extended the hospitality to these people who were coming in. That's right. Yeah. So let's take a look next at the Haftarah section. And you might wonder, as we get into the Haftarah, is in 2 Kings chapter 4. And as we go through here, you might wonder, what on earth does this have to do with anything of what we just read? You might wonder, well, this just seems like a complete non sequitur. But remember the punchline of this, as one delivered back from the dead. That is the connection of why this section is tied to the passage that we just read, from 18 through 22. Because really, this whole passage is building to that in chapter 22. And this 2 Kings chapter 4 is building upon that as well. Now a certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets cried out to Elisha, Your servant, my husband, is dead, and you know that your servant feared the Lord, and the creditor has come to take my children to be his slaves. So Elisha said to her, what shall I do for you? Tell me, what do you have in the house? And she said, your maidservant has nothing in the house except a jar of oil. Then he said, go, borrow vessels at large for yourself from all your neighbors, even empty vessels. Do not get just a few. And you shall go in and shut the door behind you and your sons and pour out into all the vessels, and you shall set aside what is full. So she went from him and shut the door behind her and her sons, and they were bringing the vessels to her, and she poured. When the vessels were full, she said to her son, bring me another vessel. And he said to her, there's not one vessel more. And the oil stopped. Then she came and told the man of God, and he said, go sell the oil and pay your debt, and you and your sons can live on the rest. Now there came a day when Elisha passed over to Shunem, where there was a prominent woman, and she persuaded him to eat food. And so it was, as often as he passed by, he turned in there to eat food. She said to her husband, behold now, I perceive that this is a holy man of God passing by us continually. Please, let us make a little walled upper chamber, and let us set a bed for him up there, and a table, and a chair, and a lampstand. And it shall be, when he comes to us, that he can turn in there. One day he came there and turned into the upper chamber and rested. Then he said to Gehazi, his servant, call this Shunammite. And when he had called her, she stood before him. He said to him, say now to her, behold, you have been careful with us with all this care, and what can we do for you? Would you be spoken for to the king or to the captain of the army? And she answered, I live among my own people. So he said, what then is to be done for her? And Gehazi answered, truly, she has no son, and her husband is old. He said, call her. And when he called her, she stood in the doorway. Then he said, at this season next year, you will embrace a son. She said, oh, no, my Lord, O man of God, do not lie to your maidservant. The woman conceived and bore a son at this season, the next year, as Elisha had said to her. When the child was grown, the day came that he went out to his father to the reapers. And he said to his father, my head, my head. And he said to his servant, carry him to his mother. And when he had taken him in and brought him to his mother, he sat on her lap until noon and then died. She went up and laid on him on the bed of the man of God and shut the door behind him and went out. She called to her husband and said, please send me one of the servants and one of the donkeys that I may run to the man of God and return. He said, why will you go to him today? It's neither a new moon or a Shabbat. And she said, it will be well. Then she saddled the donkey and said to her servant, drive and go forward. Do not slow down the pace for me unless I tell you. So she went and came to the man of God to Mount Carmel. When the man of God saw her at the distance, he said to Gehazi's servant, behold, there is a Shunammite. Please run now to meet her and say to her, is it well with you? Is it well with your husband? Is it well with your child? And she answered, it is well. When she came to the man of God to the hill, she caught hold of his feet. And Gehazi came near to push her away, but the man of God said, let her alone, for her soul is troubled within her. And the Lord has hidden it from me and has not told me. Then she said, did I ask for a son from my Lord? Did I not say, do not deceive me? Then he said to Gehazi, gird up your loins and take my staff in your hand and go your way. If you meet any man, do not salute him. And if anyone salutes you, do not answer him. And lay my staff on the lad's face. The mother of the lad said, as the Lord lives and as you yourself live, I will not leave you. And he rose and followed her. Then Gehazi passed on before them and laid the staff on the lad's face. But there was no sound or response. So he returned to meet him and told him, The lad has not awakened. When Elisha came into the house, behold, the lad was dead and laid on his bed. So he entered and shut the door behind them both and prayed to the Lord. And he went up and lay on the child and put his mouth on his mouth and his eyes on his eyes and his hands on his hands and stretched himself out on him. And the flesh of the child became warm. Then he returned and walked in the house back and forth and went up and stretched himself on him. And the lad sneezed 7 times and the lad opened his eyes. He called Gehazi and said, "Call this Shunammite." So he called her. And when she came into him, he said, "Take up your son." Then she went in and fell at his feet and bowed herself to the ground, and she took up her son and went out. When Elisha returned to Gilgal, there was a famine in the land. As the sons of the prophets were sitting before him, he said to his servant, "Put a large pot and boil stew for the sons of the prophets." Then one went out to the field to gather herbs and found a wild vine and gathered it from it. His lap full of wild gourds, and came and sliced them in the pot of stew, for they did not know what they were. So they poured it out for the men to eat, and as they were eating the stew, they cried out and said, "O man of God, there is death in the pot," and they were unable to eat. But he said, "Now bring a meal." He threw it into the pot and said, "Pour it out for the people that they may eat." Then there was no harm in the pot. Now a man came from Baal Shalisha and brought the man of God bread of the first fruits, 20 loaves of barley, and fresh ears of grain from in his sack. And he said, "Give them to the people that they may eat." His attendant said, "What will I set before 100 men?" But he said, "Give them to the people that they may eat. For thus the Lord says, they shall eat and have some left over." So he set it before them, and they ate and had some left over, according to the word of the Lord. Hallelujah. So when you look in this, you got a number of, you know, these little vignettes you have about, you know, first you have this about the never-ending oil that came there and they were able to sell it. Then you've got the accounts here of this Shunammite woman. And you might have noticed the banner there in the back. They're talking about coming up with Hanukkah. And you'll see 8 women listed up there. And you'll notice that those are very prominent women that you see in Scripture. And a characteristic that they all have among them is what? Sarah, Rivka, Raquel, Hannah, Manoah's wife, this woman we just read about, Elisheva, Miriam, barren, all of them barren, until God was the one who brought the promise. So God was the one who brought the promise for all these women in a case where you thought it was impossible, that it was something that you would say the natural result was going to be something different. There was no children in those cases of those women. Those 8 women there. But you see in the cases of each one of these things, a oil bottle that never ends. Then you see of a dead son that comes back to life. First, she was barren and wasn't going to have any kids. Then she's given a kid and then the kid dies. So when you talk about trusting in where God is going to lead you, and not trusting in the things that you see right in front of you and what you think the outcome is going to be and what you think is really happening. I mean, these are some great examples of it. And they're throughout all of the history of the people of God. Stuff that you don't think is even possible or conceivable is something that is actually a great outcome that's going to come from it. And you think about it, even it ends up with this account here of the poison stew. You know, you think of it today with people who go foraging for mushrooms. I mean, that you get the wrong one and you're toast. Well, if you think about this, it's like someone mixed a nice little death cap stew and everybody is saying, "Oh, there's death in this pot." Well, yeah, indeed. There's a number of things out there that will kill you if you cook them and eat them. Yeah, make you real sick. So these are all cases here of a huge turnabout in events and really trusting in what God is going to do and trusting what his word says and his character says he's going to do about it. So it's interesting when you see this account in this chapter of the Shunammite woman. What are some things that you really see that are very similar to the account you see of Yitzhak? Promise kid, okay. Promise kid. What are some other characteristics you see? Yeah, you think of promise kid, but also trusting he died. Okay, in this case, he died, but doesn't it seem odd that she's like, okay, and to the point of like saying, it is well, and you might say, all right, well, maybe she was just trying to get past the gatekeeper, you know, get past the assistant. It's kind of like if you call in and get a receptionist and, you know, try to sweet talk the receptionist so you can get in to talk to the CEO. In this case, we see by her actions that she actually said, and you could sort of get the idea that she really did think it is well. It is well, it was going to end okay because this was a promise that was coming forward. But then you see her gripping on to his legs and saying, well, this, are you still fooling with me here? Because you said I was going to have a son, and he came, then he died. But you see this kind of an interesting kind of picture of her going between actions that look like, okay, complete trust, he said I'm going to have a son, it's going to be fine, to, oh wow, this is a gut-wrenching situation here. He's dead. I was going to have a son. I wasn't possible to have a son before. Now I have a son. Now he's dead.
Well, my take on this is that she didn't want to go through secondhand. She wanted to get to the main guy. And she knew how to do that. And she was bound and determined. I think that prophet said something's got to be wrong because she wouldn't be coming here. That's something I would do. I wouldn't play with the second guy. I would do everything she did to get to him. And then I would have grabbed on his feet and said, hey, I didn't ask you for a son. You told me I could have one, but now he's dead, you know?
Yeah, so. And that's really a good point because Messiah told similar parables of that. He used one that calls it the unrighteous judge. And it seems very odd to see God pictured like that. The Messiah is basically saying that God may come across as being someone who's just totally unjust as a judge. But then the constant pleading here. And it's one of those things that God says, it's in my heart to actually do this. So the trusting in what God said he's going to bring forward is something that he's actually going to bring forward. And it's actually something that the prophet Isaiah brings out in chapter 45. And he says that, did I create Israel for nothing? In vain? To go into nothingness? No, I didn't create it to be nothing, but to be great. So thus, there was a picture there with the coming exiles and everything, that just like with Moshe said at the end of Deuteronomy, that this, what looks like is a coming disaster, is not going to end in a disaster. This is not the way I wanted it to go, but basically he's going to bring back Israel from the dead.
But Abba also says, don't bother asking for something if you don't actually believe he'll follow through with it.
Yeah.
So, you know.
So, yeah, it's also, but in those certain things where he has said he's going to do something, then to trust what he says he's actually going to do. Because, you know, that's one of those things that we can say and, you know, try to In some cases, put God to the test, so to speak, in pushing him to do something that is not something that he wanted to do. And in those cases, it's one of those things that it may be his will to do it, but it's almost like those friends of Daniel who are facing the flames, you know, even if he kills me, even if he doesn't save me from this furnace, I'm going to still follow him. But when God specifically says he's going to do it, He brings it forward and actually does it. And that's where the trust thing, that all this passage that we've seen here in Genesis and what we just read here in the Haftarah from 2 Kings chapter 4, that's all about that. It's all about if God says he's going to bring something forward, he's going to actually do it. And that's something that also the Apostle Paul brings out. And he says, this good work that he started in you, he is going to bring that forward. So just like Israel, he didn't just start Israel and he's going to just leave it to sputter out, because he said it was going to be something great. It was going to be a blessing for all nations. So trust that that is what is going to happen. It may not look like it's going to happen. And you've seen all the accounts in here we've seen so far. There's a lot of these cases where it looked pretty bleak and impossible that anything like that was going to happen.
But Yahushua says that in the latter times he will give us the ability to do everything that he did and more.
Yep.
But we have to trust that it actually is true, that he's not lying to us.
That's right.
So things like, you know, healing Greg's leg, knee, you know, yeah, his knee was hurting him, and it wasn't me that did it. It was me trusting that Abba can heal Greg's knee.
Yeah, we praise God for all the great things that just seemed like unbelievable miracles that happen.
Is the end of this like kind of like when Messiah made the bread?
Yeah, it is. It is interesting when you noted that there were pieces left over.
Yeah,
in that case, it was the 12 baskets and then 7 baskets, and it's a whole other discussion there, but it is interesting that you've got, when he's there on one side, kind of the Israel side of the sea, it's 12 baskets, and then it was kind of on the nation side, it's more the Greek side, it was 7 baskets. So 7, 70 nations, kind of like the completeness. He's going to have, there is going to be all of the house, all 12 tribes will be picked up and recovered. All 7, the whole completeness of the nations will be recovered. So when Paul's writing later there in chapter 11 of Romans, and he says, you know, that's this kind of blinding of Israel and some of the leadership going on in Israel is going to happen until the fullness, till that whole 7, all the 7 baskets, so to speak, of the nations are brought in. And then the 12 baskets totally of Israel brought in. So yeah, that's a great observation. I was thinking the same thing as we were going through that. So as we close up here, any other observations from the parasha or the Haftarah reading so far? It'd be good to look at. Oh, just was wondering if there's any questions from some of the other parts of the parasha from Genesis 18 through 22, or passage you just looked at from 2 Kings.
I am curious about the flour, throwing in the flour to save the soup. I could throw sour.
What is he making, gravy?
Yeah, what does that mean? Because usually, if you've got death in the pot, flour's not going to work it.
But one of those things is, you could say, a great symbol of the well, not only belief, but also, you could say, a little bit of an offering. Because, you know, flour, when you think of offerings, when you think of flour, then like the mincha offering, that kind of an offering in there. So it's one of those things of, oh, God is, it's another little reinforcing thing. God is the one who's bringing this forward. Yeah, or gravy, a nice gravy in there. Yeah. So let's. Oh, yes.
Sorry. Is he a false worshiper because of his name? The one that, see right here?
The Baal Shalib, yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things to remember is that Baal means master or lord. So there is the deity called Baal, but then there's like all lots of Baals. Baal Zaphon, Baal this, Baal that. One's of thunder, one's of this, one's of that. It just means like lord or master of something. So it's kind of... Yeah, it's like a master or something. So that's one of those things to be somewhat clear. Sometimes when you see these names, you almost wish that they were written out like Native American names. So they're just like in plain English, what it is they're referring to. Cause you can get sometimes a little confused as to what's being referred to. But head down there. Let's kind of close out with that Hebrews passage in chapter 11. And we're going to be reading actually from verse 8 down through, down through 19. So by faith, Abraham, when he was called, obeying by going out to a place which he was to receive for inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. And by faith, he lived as an alien in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, dwelling in the tents with Yitzhak and Yaakov, fellow heirs of the same promise. For he was looking for a city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. By faith, even Sarah herself received the ability to conceive, even beyond the proper time of life, since she considered him faithful who had promised. Therefore, there was born of one man, of him as good as dead as that, as many descendants as the stars of heaven in number, and innumerable as the sand which is by the seashore. All these died in faith without receiving promises, but having seen them and having welcomed them at it from a distance, and having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For those who say such things make it clear that they are seeking a country of their own. And indeed, if they had been thinking of that country from which they went out, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. By faith, when Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Yitzhak, and he who had received the promises was offering up his only begotten son. It was he to whom it was said, Yitzhak, your descendants shall be called. He considered that God is able to raise people even from the dead, from which he also received him back as a type. And that, in varying translations there, it says as a type. It says at the end it's parabola, which is parable, as a parable. So that thing of the getting back from the dead, just like you mentioned, was pointing forward to something else that was going to happen. So when we see these things that are messianic prophecies pointing forward, they're really pointing forward to something great that God is doing. And one of those things that should be a great lesson in all of this is to trust that when God said he's going to do something, and when God said he's going to bring something forward, he actually is going to do it. And I know I came from a tradition that tended to see a lot of what you see in the prophets about what God said he was going to do in the latter days or in the day of the Lord and such as an alternate reality, stuff that would just like never happen because Israel was cut off. So when Israel was cut off, all those promises went out the window. And, you know, we all have kind of traditions we may have heard of or interacted with or friends and family who have similar sort of backing. But one of the things that we can see in all of this, and especially in the life of Abraham, who is the father of faith through Messiah, is that when God says he's going to do something, it may take a lot longer than we ever think and be totally impossible. But if he said it's going to happen, it's going to happen. Yeah. Sometimes 2 years, sometimes 1 year, sometimes thousands of years. So it's one of those things that it is going to happen. So let's close out in prayer. Father God, we thank you for giving us the testimony of all your servants. And Father, we ask for your help and your spirit to give us strength as we trust in you. As a lot of times we just cannot see over the horizon and see where it is that we're going. We can't even fathom that the direction you're taking us in is the direction that we need to be going. And Father, we thank you for strengthening us in your words. And Father, we just ask for you to build our trust in your words. We thank you for these things in the name of your Son, Yeshua. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hillel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hillel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hillel.info.